I can get depressed. That's our topic this hour, is we're going to talk about depression and the impact that has in our lives and those around us. Depression takes on several areas of dynamics, including everything from clinical depression, where a person is almost immobilized by their depression, maybe can't even get out of bed, doesn't want to get out of bed, pull the covers up, want the world to go away. Sometimes those are situational, as in the case of a grief and a loss, and dealing with the impact of that. Sometimes they are organic or chemical in nature, where such as in postpartum depression. And sometimes they are as the result of sin, that our sins find us out, and we are taken to God's woodshed with His discipline, and sometimes that stops us and creates in us a depression. So we've got a lot of material to cover this afternoon. I'll try not to race through it so much to where we fly across the surface and learn nothing, but at the same time I need to move at a fairly rapid pace in this particular presentation. Some of the PowerPoints I will be skipping in this section in order to dwell more on a piece I want to do at the very end here. And we're not on for some reason. That would be... It's coming. It's coming, okay? All right, so I will walk on water. okay, so... in the area of depression, there are examples in the Bible of people who were actually would meet the criteria of clinical depression. I want to look at a couple of those cases toward the end. So, in the beginning, let's talk about what depression is, and ask the question of what occurs when a person is depressed. When people are depressed. When people are depressed, they tend to time slows down for them. We hear kind of a distorted or dysmorphic response to life. Things seem to slow down. We tend to have tunnel vision. The future seems like it's hopeless. The hallmark words that people use when they're depressed is, "I feel there is no hope," "I feel hopeless," and "I feel helpless." When people talk about feeling hopeless and helpless, the question that I always ask, and that you'll want to ask too, is the question of lethality. And I ask the question, I don't hedge it at all, are you suicidal? And we need to know the answer to that. Are you thinking of hurting yourself? And if the answer to that is yes, or it's crossed my mind, then you need to get some pretty immediate attention. Don't blow that, just pass that off. But that would be something that would call for a referral. You may want to talk until the referral gets there, but that's a referral. That can become very life-threatening. Sometimes people who are depressed talk about it's hard to concentrate, confusion even in making some of the simple decisions. As to, you know, do I get up, do I go to school or class or whatever it is that's going on. And often people talk about, I just feel numb. The joy and the pleasure has gone out of my life and I don't feel anything. And often that's because there's something else going on I'll talk about in just a moment. So the question, are you depressed? I feel like a person may say, I feel like I'm a guilty person. I just feel I've messed up so bad in life that I just deserve to be punished. And all the evil that's coming down on me, I just deserve it because I've been such a bad person. You can see how that negative thinking kind of could lead you into quite a dark hole if that's the way we're viewing life. Someone says, well, I just feel like a failure. I feel lifeless. I feel like I'm more dead than alive, and maybe I'd be better off dead. And people talk like that, and those are scary terms when they talk about depression. Depression goes with sleep disturbance. Sometimes people have too much sleep. They want to sleep all the time. That's an effort to make it all go away. Or they don't want to sleep at all, because when they sleep, it is close to a death-like experience, and there's a fear there that if I go to sleep, I'll never wake up. So there can be that kind of a fear. Or a person may just feel like they're broken. Sometimes a person may spend time thinking of suicidal kinds of things. The lethargy, just kind of a sadness about them. Everything seems like it, you know, not worth the effort, too much trouble. Are you depressed yet? We talked about sleep disturbance, waking up after a night of sleep and feeling like you didn't sleep, just tired, no energy. Waking up, not being able to concentrate, irritable, snappy with people, just kind of yowie and let me alone. Exhaustion, for those that are in sexually active, they report a lack of a libido. It's just like things that excite you don't excite you anymore. And then a sensation of utter despair. Okay. I'm going to zip through some of these. Fear of death comes in there. Phobias, that would be unnatural fears. And sometimes people get fears of everything. Maybe they get a fear of riding down the street or fear of what the neighbors are saying. Sometimes we get other kinds of things. Obsessive behaviors, like when we leave home. Well, I really didn't want to leave home to start with. Did we turn the iron off? Did we lock the door? And we start rotating back around, second guessing, overthinking, and second guessing things, and usually driving people crazy that are around us when we're doing that. These are all symptoms of depression. Obviously, high anxiety falls in this category. Crying, bouts of crying or uncontrolled crying, an inability to stop, and as we talked about, suicidal kinds of things. Changes in appetite and weight would be that a person just stops eating, or a person sits down, they're depressed, they grab a bag of Doritos, you'd think they'd have one or two, and they have the whole bag, maybe go for a second. We see that. There are some medical causes of depression, and some of these have to do with hormonal things, as we've noted here. Depression sometimes can be with persons who are diagnosed as bipolar or manic depressant, then the depression can be the depression side of the mania. The mania displays itself in irrational thoughts, moving very quickly, racing thoughts, usually lack of sleep, feeling like I've done I've got the greatest thoughts on earth. I'm getting so much done when I'm in this phase, and I'm just energized, just moving around, just full of energy. Now, the way people are around you, they don't see it that way. But the racing mind thinks that these are the most wonderful things that could happen. We'll get impulsive stuff that goes on. Usually impulsive sexual behavior is in there somewhere. Impulsive decisions. Sometimes decision to pick up and go across the country. Shopping decisions are in here. Persons out here and they're in a manic phase. They may buy everything they see. Lack of discretion and good judgment when we're in the manic phase. But in the depressed phase, the person may not even hardly be able to make it through a day. Even a single task can feel like too big of a task. That's the bipolar cycle. And there is some genetic base to bipolar disorder. Wish we had more time to go into that, and maybe if you want to talk more, we can during another session. Now I want to say that sometimes the medical issues here with depression are maybe a problem that a person needs to go have some things checked out. One of the first things I ask a person before I get into the psyche or the mental or the addiction piece of it is ask them, when's the last time you had a good physical? Now, I don't mean the kind where you walk in and get a five-minute checklist, a good physical with blood work. When's the last time you had that? And a lot of times people tell me, well, it's been a while. It's like, well, before we really get started, we're going to have to rule out some things. We need to know from, like, for instance, an executive panel with laboratories, we want to know where your chemistry is. Talked to a lady a few weeks ago that was just horribly depressed and came to me. She just felt she was crying. She was doing a lot of these other things here and came to me and we were talking. And I asked her, I said, when's the last time you had a physical? And she told me she was into holistic medicine, which is fine. And so I said, well, you need to go and have a good physical. When she came back to me, what we found out is her sunshine vitamin, vitamin D, was chronically low. She was being impacted by seasonal affective disorder, which basically is a lack of sunlight. And once we got that back under control, got the thyroid working right, guess what? I didn't have anything much to talk with her about, because her problems were medical in nature, not psychiatric. We did talk a lot because I like to give money for stuff, but we did talk. I didn't say that. So she has a plan, but it's not a plan to be depressed. Generalized anxiety or generalized illnesses. Sometimes we have our system is drugged down by we may have toxins in our system. We may have other things going on that our body's not processing things properly, and so our system's sluggish, our life is our thinking sluggish as a result of that. So those are medical things that would be addressed under this. We talked about sunlight, alcoholism. Remember that alcohol is a central nervous system depressant. And people who drink alcohol, why would you take a depressed person and give them something to make them more depressed? But that's what happens when you add alcohol to this equation. Watch a person who is depressed that is taking alcohol, because many times that person can get into suicidal depression. And you never say he just needs to sleep it off or she needs to sleep it off. What you do is you call 911. Okay? And have that number memorized. Okay? You may need it again. Okay. Sometimes people have food allergies, and they don't always realize that, and they show the symptoms of depression when really these are really symptoms of food allergies. And again, that's a medical issue. What I'm saying is depression has multiple facets, and only part of those impact mental health and addiction kind of stuff. The vulnerable person... Okay, I'm going to skip through some of this. Okay. Depression is not just in a person's mind. Sometimes what people do in an attempt to help folks is they tell them, well, you need to go do this and this and this and this and this. And we think we've helped them by telling them what to do. And most of the people who are depressed say, after they told me what to do, I feel depressed because I don't have the energy to get them to do that. You know, and I'm really now I'm disappointing even more people, because they're telling me to do stuff. And what is much better in your approach with them, if you ask them, what are some things that you might be able to do? How have you dealt with this in the past? If you've had bouts like this, what are the answers are in that person. And what you might be able to do is help them to kind of think it through, to work it through. And sometimes we get into what I call cognitive distortions, that the individual has come up with is working on something that maybe has got them depressed that may not be a reality. Do you remember Joseph and his father Jacob? And when the coat came back to him with blood on it, do you remember what happened to that man? He acted as if there had actually been a death, but he had wrong information. And sometimes that's what happens, is people have wrong information and they go into a depression from wrong information. Sometimes we have right information, and the depression is a natural and logical result of the information we received. It's a human experience. By the way, there is nothing in the Bible that guarantees us all happy days. Happy Days was a TV show. That's not us. So you're going to have happy days, you'll have sad days, there'll be a range of those. And when I worked the suicide hotline, what I would always do in trying to establish that initial connection, someone called me and tell me they're going to shoot their head off or do something to themselves, one of the first things I would ask is, would anything change if you talked to me 20 minutes? And they'd usually say, well, I don't think so. It's like, all right, so if you're going to do something to yourself, then, you know, that's something you could postpone for at least 20 minutes. Could you do that? Would you commit yourself to that? And then in that, I talk with them. Here's what I know that sometimes they don't know. And what I know is that the human mind, when it's in a state of depression, cannot usually stay in deep depression for longer than 15 to 18 minutes. When I ask them to commit to me for 20 minutes, what I'm asking them to do is commit to me till we work through this thing, because that intensity cannot remain much longer than 15 to 18 minutes. And so at the end of that, then what we do is I've collected some information, and by that time I've kind of figured out where they are and what kind of help works and who else might even be in the house at the same time, that they can lay the phone down, go get the person, and come back. And now we've got help there with them. We're not talking about people who are lazy and say, well, I'm just depressed, so you know, I'm just a slug. This is not about being a slug or being lazy. It is not about having some sad days or some blue days, and it's not about being in high stress. The other thing I would look at is that Christians are not exempt from this. Sometimes we have situations in life that just knock us off course, and one of the first questions we might ask is, why me, Lord? And the question that comes back is, why not you? Who's better able to deal with some of the things that happen in life than the people that have God on their side? So why not me? And why not me also says that the great lessons that we learn in life are not on the tops of the mountains. The great lessons in life throughout the scriptures were learned in the valleys. And the lessons are there for you and me. When we have to come face to face with ourselves, even as some terms say, and when he came to himself, the prodigal son, he had to come face to face with the situation, and then there needed to be a resolve. That's how we deal with depression. So sometimes depression can have a positive outcome if we approach it with the right disposition. Depression is not something that a person necessarily brought on by choice, and it's not something we can fix by just telling the person, well, just snap out of it. Come on, let's go fishing. You know, that's not going to cure it. I tell people my magic wand's in the shop. You know, it has been for several years. Must be a problem fixing that. There are major causes of depression, and here are some of those listed. Sometimes people get depressed with learned helplessness. And what that means is, if I act like I'm so low in the dumps, then what I will do is I will get a secondary gain from this. That if I act like I'm depressed, you'll do it for me. If I act like I'm depressed, I'll get your attention. And so sometimes there are secondary gains. Do not feed a secondary gain. Those are hard to decipher sometimes. But if you feel like a person is exploiting or using you, then don't do this. Young people, sometimes a boyfriend or a girlfriend will say, oh man, you know, if you break up with me, I don't know what I'll do. I'll go kill myself. And, oh, don't do that. Don't do that. And so we don't break up with them. Don't buy into that. That's exploitation. And if someone is that sick, they need to get help, and you're not the one to help them. So biological factors are included in this. Sometimes there can be brain tumors. That does happen. It's not the most frequent cause. And sometimes there are glandular disorders. The thyroid would be one of the main ones in that. And other times that there are chemical imbalances. And what I mean by that is the neurotransmitters in the brain. Some people are lower on dopamine than others. Some norepinephrine is out of whack with some. Drug addicts, when they're coming off their drugs, their body is in disequilibrium for a while, and they're going to have kind of the highs and the lows, and like you're riding in a surfing wave part of the time with ups and downs and all arounds. If somebody wants to ask me about pause, I'll tell you about pause a little later, but that's another subject. There are some common types of depression. The one is major depression that's very debilitating. We talked about that, where you don't want to move. The other is dysthymia. Now, dysthymia is a low-grade depression that basically this person is functional, but the joy has left Mudville. There is no happiness. The person walks around just a generalized sadness. You know anybody like that? I often tell people, and it takes the joy out of their cartoons, that if you want to see clinical depression, then watch Winnie the Pooh. Eeyore is clinically depressed. By the way, Christopher Robbins is the therapist. And by the way, Tigger's manic. By the way, that series is the personality disorders put into cartoon form. If you want a little bit more insight into that. Okay, we've talked about all those things, so let's move on. Okay. Men are less likely to admit to depression. And the way depression shows in men is usually with isolation and anger. These are the guys going to throw the hammer across the garage. They're going to go into fits of rage. Anybody know any men like that? Any of you men know anybody like that? But men are less likely to admit they're depressed. And, you know, real men don't get depressed. Real men don't have problems in life. And so men often do not admit to this. Women experience depression about twice as often as men. Actually, that's a misstatement. Women report depression about twice as often as men would be more accurate. Men's depression is often masked by chemicals. They will go out and try to self-medicate with alcohol or some other drug or some other thing like workaholism. And that can be, you know, I don't know what to do. I'm helpless and hopeless in the situation that I'm trying to avoid. And so men's response to depression is often very avoidant. And obviously what we see is life getting out of balance with alcohol or drugs or with work or with promiscuity or something that brings things back into excitement again. Our next lesson will feed off that a little bit. And discouragement is a big one also with men. All depression is not destructive. You've already had a series on the stages on grief with Wilson, my cousin, and David from down in Bowling Green. You've already had excellent presentations on that, so I'm not going to repeat all that. I want to go to some Bible verses now and then spend our time with a couple of Bible cases. Job talked about, you remember Job's situation? All right, now I want you to imagine this man for just a moment. Here's a man that gets up one morning, and before the end of the day, that he has lost everything that's precious to him, except his wife. Here's a man gets up, and here's a tornado come and blows the house down where his kids are having a family gathering. They're having a family situation, and tornado comes and blows the house down, and all 10 of them are dead. Someone comes and tells Job about that. The text says, and immediately, which means these things followed in rapid sequence. Immediately, now we have a situation where, hey, all your cattle are gone. All the sheep are gone. All the oxen are gone. All the stuff's gone. And Job's having a bad day. Here's a wealthy man who's lost most of the things that are special to him and that make his day kind of be cohesive. He's lost everything. And then on top of that, his response is a statement of sadness. He says, may darkness and deep shadow of death claim it once more. May a cloud settle over it. May blackness overwhelm its night, its light. Does that sound like a depressed person? Okay. Here's a man that had a reason to be depressed. He suffered significant losses. And so now it's just like someone's pulled the window shade down. His life's come to a standstill. The things he held precious are not there. Okay. And yet we're told in all this Job sinned not. And here's what I'm looking at, is that this is a normal response to something that we don't understand or that he didn't understand. The truth of the matter is you and I understood what I don't know he ever understood. Because there's no indication in the book of Job that he knew what we knew from the first chapter. For whatever reason, that there was a conflict going on with God and Satan, and what Satan had told God is that Job serves you, does not serve you for nothing. He's serving you just for what he's getting out of it. And what God says, God allows Satan to stretch forth his hand and takes away every apparent reason, all the stuff that it looks like Job is getting out of it, and all this is for a reason, is to show the character of this man that even when he does without, that he's going to do the right thing. That's what the debate's about. And so Satan reaches out his hand and starts taking away his stuff and his family and the things that he's close to. And then in that you note that Job's wife is left behind. And sometimes those closest to us can be a source of depression too. How would you like to be depressed and have your wife tell you, why don't you just die? You know, what a thrill. You know, why don't you just die? You know, well, that didn't do it either. And so now we have the second bout of Satan taking away things. He now attacks the man's physical. He takes away his health. And this man is covered with boils. In the daytime, he wants the night to come. And in the night, he wants the daytime to come. He is one miserable man. He can't roll over. He can't stand anyway. He can't even stand on top of his head because he's got boils from the top of his head to the soles of his feet. This man's miserable. Now, those boils grow and pop. And you imagine the ugliness, the ooze that comes from that. And so he's scratching himself with that old pot, like we talked about the other night. Job was a judge in the city. And now because he is diseased, he is put outside of the city on a trash dump with those that are around him that he helped to kick out of the city. Here's the judge that exiled them from the city, and now they're around him, and they're spitting on him, calling him names. And of all the wonderful things happened, now here come four of your friends to encourage you. And they sit and stare at you for 4 days. 40 days. Now wouldn't that just thrill you? And then finally one speaks up and says, you know, the reason you're suffering so bad is you're a great sinner. You know, it's all your fault. Now, we'll leave that story where it is, but what I want you to see is this is the setting in which Job made this statement. He did not understand what was happening. Now I want you to look at his anger. You who tear yourself to pieces in your anger, is the earth to be abandoned for your sakes? Or must the rocks be moved from their place? He's lashing out at these friends. Job 18 and verse 4. And then as a need for comfort, Job becomes a comforter to others. And what he says is that, you know, I'm the one that needed help, but I'm having to give you help. I chose the way from them and sat as their chief. I dwell as a king among his troops. I was like one who comforts mourners. And so in the midst of he's needing help and he's having to give help. And you ever reach a point where you had so much energy expended, you felt you had nothing more to give, and yet the situation demanded that you give a little bit more. You're running on fumes. That's this statement from a depressed man. Guilt involves confession. David had committed adultery with Bathsheba, and he was depressed because of his sin until finally he confessed his sin. And in Psalm 32, this is depression that results from sin. Your sins will find you out. And when they find you out, you may be real depressed. You take a person who's been out fooling around their family, and that comes to light, and the family busts up, you're going to be depressed more than likely. And that's a similar thing happened here. And David talks about his bones grew old when he tried to hide his secrets. That he needed to open up and acknowledge what was going on and let God help him to remedy this. Through my groaning all the day long for day and night, your hand was heavy upon me. My vitality was turned into the drought of summer. That's a statement of depression, but it's depression that is brought about by the circumstances of sin. Your sins do find you out. For every wild oat you sow, then there will not be a crop failure, there will be a crop harvest. Your sins will find you out. Well, sometimes David again talks about his guilt, maybe from unawareness. Why are you cast down, O my soul? And why would you disquiet within me? Hope in God, for I shall yet praise him for the help of his countenance, for you are the God of my strength. Here's a man that's in the valley that's reaching out to God, trying to find answers to that which he cannot fathom or make sense of in his own mind. All right. We talk about the causes of depression. Sometimes families are depressed families. And depressed is a lifestyle because the families have taken on a negative glow about them. When you see these families walk in, it's kind of like a cloud hanging over their head, that they're just a sadness about them. They've learned to cope with life as in the negative, and nothing's going on right. And it's just like a cloud about these individuals. So it can be very symptomatic in families. That's more of a learning style. And those things can be corrected, but those are corrected by looking at that there is joy and happiness and peace that God intends. God makes promises that if we come out from among them, that he will be our God and we'll be his people, and that God will give us rewards and blessings with that, and those blessings should evoke emotions in us, and the emotions should not be gloom and doom. One of the saddest things about our Christian, and I'll use the term Christian witness, kind of accommodatively, And that is one of the saddest things, is when we walk around like we've been weaned on a sour pickle, and we walk around with this awful look on our face, and we're looking down at the ground, and then we go out and say, let me teach you about God and how He can change your life. And people looking at you say, well, maybe He needs to change yours first. That's what they're thinking. Because that's the aura or the impression that we have, that, you know, I'm miserable being a Christian, and come on, let me help you be miserable too. No deal on that. I don't want to have that kind of a deal going. So the question is, all those who are excited about the Lord need to say so. Those who appreciate their blessings need to say so. One of the things I do with my veterans, each morning at 9 o'clock, my time, you can figure where I'm going to be, and you can just look at your clock. It'll be a different time your time. But at 9 o'clock my time, every morning, the veterans get together. These are people who have been homeless. They've come from under porches and bridges and a number of things. And what I tell them is, when they come in the program at 9 o'clock in the morning, I don't want to hear what's wrong. I don't want you to tell me what's bad. I want you to come together, and I want you to go around the room, and I want each one of you to tell me three things that you're grateful for. We start our day out with gratitude. At first, they kind of didn't like that, and they did like they usually do, kick and scream. But that's all right. We got through that. But what I'm learning now is the depth of what they're saying. One of the things that addicts, alcoholics, and people who have been down in the trenches, one of the things they've forgotten to do is to be grateful. And that's in Romans 1, talks about those who have left God and that God gave up on, is their thankless heart was darkened. Their thankless heart was darkened. They forgot to thank God for the things that He had done for them. And so I start each day with gratitude. I do that in my own life, and I recommend that in the life of every Christian. I start each morning with them, with what are you thankful for? What are your goals for today? This isn't a flop house. God's given you this day. It's not a day to be wasted. What's your plans? And then at the end of the day, at 7 o'clock every evening, we gather back together. We talk about how we did on our goals, what were our strengths, what were our barriers, what are the things that we need to carry into tomorrow. And we wrap our day up, and that way we have, you got it, one day at a time. Just like a sandwich. Okay? So I recommend that to Christians. I recommend that to families. Maybe you get together. This isn't a time for discussion. It's just a time to check in with each other. And what's going on today? Well, today I'm grateful. You know, I'm grateful that test I was about to take got postponed. Today I'm thankful for whatever it might be. And it may just be something as simple as I'm thankful for windshield washers that work. It got me through a tight space here. I'm thankful for my health. Whatever it is you're thankful for, how often do we stop and maybe take that inventory? I'll leave that as it is, but I really strongly recommend that'll make a major difference in your day if you started out with thankfulness rather than turn the TV on and find out who got killed, who got shot, and how bad the taxes got raised. You'll have a better day if you look at what you're thankful for rather than what's so bad about everything. All right. In the family, we have several symptoms of depression. We'll have an abusive family. Family that's under depression, they're going to be turning on each other, turn their anger and their energy toward each other, and they're going to be biting and devouring each other. Churches can also get into this spot. There will be anger. As a matter of fact, one of the working definitions of depression is this. Depression is anger turned inward. When I worked in an inpatient psych ward, one of the things that I would rather work with than anything else is the other side. I would rather work with a patient who was acting out. This would be the one that would punch a wall or would come up and get in your face that we may have to physically get involved in subduing. But I would rather work with that kind of a person that I see what I'm dealing with than I would with a person who goes into depression, because that person turns their anger inward and their anger begins to rest. Anger doesn't go away. Anger that's not expressed doesn't go away. It goes somewhere. Usually it goes inside, and it's turned with a depressed person. It's turned on that individual, and they begin eating themselves up from the inside out with negative thoughts and self-abasement and all kinds of things that are not healthy. And then it often comes out, when it does get pushed and come out, it comes out in the form of rage, And that's where families explode and situations explode, because we've got someone that didn't deal appropriately with their anger. Okay. Sometimes people deflect their anger by doing all kinds of crazy stuff. We're not going to have time to go into all of that. We talked about rules in the addicted family, and these also feed depression. If we don't feel, we don't talk, we don't trust, we don't think, and we don't change, those are the unspoken rules, then what we have is a closed system that's not going to be able to help itself, because it's the problem. And since it's closed, other people aren't going to be able to get in to have much impact on you. That's why we need open systems, to where when the family needs help from outside, the family is receiving of that help from outside rather than blocking that. And shame and all that kind of stuff go with it. All right. What I'm going to do for now is leave the rest of that, because I want to go into something else. Obviously, much more we could talk about. But I want to go to a case in the Bible of a man who was depressed. This is a man that, if you turn to 1 Kings 18, there's a story of a man who was a prophet of God. He was one of the notable prophets of the Old Testament, and yet he suffered all the symptoms of clinical depression. I want to just look at the detail of what was driving this man's depression. We're in 1 Kings and chapters 18 and 19. I'm going to summarize chapter 18 and then most of chapter 19, but if you want to look at the detail, it's there for you. This man has actually challenged the false prophets of the Baal and the Asherah, and has challenged them to meet on Mount Carmel and there to have a showdown of who is God. And in you remember this, they have the priests from the Asherah and the Baalim, and they come and they get the first chance to call down fire to their sacrifice so their God can demonstrate that their God is God. And, of course, that doesn't happen. They begin to wail and cut on themselves and do all kinds of bizarre things, and their God doesn't respond. And then Elijah has water poured on the sacrifice and on the rocks and all that. And ultimately, he prays to God, and God calls forth, or fire is called forth and consumes the sacrifice. You remember all that. And then Elijah leads the armies of God into triumph over the pagan enemies. And they take care of that. Where would you expect this man to be in the next chapter? The great hero of faith, who has led the armies of God into victory, and who has rallied God's people to the cause, where would you expect him to be? Well, here's where he is. In chapter 19, we read about this man, who's had a bounty on his head, by the way, for several years, and suddenly the bounty is renewed, and Queen Jezebel says, I won't eat or sleep or something like that until such time as this man's dead. Well, that wasn't news. That wasn't anything new. That had been going on for several years. But this time it hit him different. And so we find him out in the wilderness, and of all things, he's sitting under a tree out in the wilderness, and let's read something about his depression. This man is sitting out here, and he is fearful. He's afraid, he's scared, something horrible, some impending doom is going to happen to me. In 1 Kings chapter 19 and verse 3, the text says, Elijah was afraid, and he ran for his life. You mean the same God that gave you victory on Mount Carmel can't be with you, my friend? He just demonstrated who he is. And now you're afraid and you tuck tail and run, is the way we'd say it. And you go out here and you run away for your life. Now, there's also some indication he may have had a death wish. Because in verse 4 it says, Elijah prayed that he might die. Does that sound like maybe we got so depressed we don't want to live? And he basically said, I've had enough, Lord. Take my life. I'm no better than my ancestors. Help me get out of this. I don't want to live anymore. That's depression. And he's so tired, he's exhausted, he has expended his energy. And the text says in verse 5 that he laid down under the tree and fell asleep. He may have slept for a couple of days or longer. You determine that from the context. But he was asleep for a little while. And then Elijah says, you know, I just feel rejected. You know, I'm on the pity pot. You know, poor me. I've been very zealous for the Lord God Almighty. The Israelites have broken your covenant and broken down your altars, put your prophets to death with a sword, and I'm the only one. And now they're trying to kill me too. Do you ever feel like you're the only one trying to do right? You look around and it's like, woe is me. And we get on our pity pot. Now part of this is what's feeding the depression. But look how this tunnel vision is coming in. He experienced this depression for a little while. The text may indicate as much as a couple of months. And so the question here with this man is, why is he so crippled by fear and by hopelessness and by despair? And in this case, it has to do with the way he's thinking. And I want to go into that, what your thoughts are will lead you to a state of elation or a state of impending doom. I hear this a lot among, as a segue, I hear this a lot among members of the church. I ask them, well, are you planning to go to heaven? And I don't get the answer that I think the Bible says. And what I hear is, I sure hope so. Like the judgment day is going to be a big surprise for them. And it's like, oh, you mean I can go? I'm going to tell you what. That is depressing. If we're doing all of this and have no real hope of a reward, then we're walking around kind of hopeless or hope neutral, and there's something wrong, something bad wrong. The Apostle Paul said this, the time of my departure is at hand, and I know there's a crown of life laid up for me. That's the message of optimism, not the message of depression that I'm afraid I'm hearing from far too many of my brethren. If we're pressing on to that high call, then why would we think that the judgment day would be a surprise? Why would we think God would not honor what He told us if we do our part? And there may be something out there in our minds that are telling us, you know, some things I'm holding back on, and maybe the problem is lack of surrender, but I tell you what, when you do the right thing, the promises go with the right thing. And that's what we need to be heading for. And I'm afraid we let ourselves get talked into sitting under a juniper tree and thinking that, well, you know, I don't know if we'll make it or not. And that's a language of defeat, not a language of victory. Well, probably Elijah was disappointed for several reasons, but you know what God said to him, and I'm going to paraphrase this. Let me tell you first what God didn't say. God didn't say, well, Elijah, I know you've overdone it, and now that I look at you, you're clinically depressed, and if you'll just hang out a couple of years, I'm going to develop a little purple pill, and we'll see that you get some of that, and you won't have to be depressed anymore. That's not what God said. I'm not against pills. Okay, a pill is not a skill. Sometimes a pill is needed to get the chemistry back in line, and sometimes a pill is needed in order to get you there until we can talk you there. But what I want to suggest to you is that God cured Elijah without a pill. And Elijah's problem was not a medical one. Elijah's problem was a faith one. Elijah's problem was that he had wrong thinking. And I'm going to try to show that to you. Now, long before there was ever psychiatry, and long before people were being healed with little purple pills, and long before we had clinics and psychiatrists and people like me, no despair to those, but long before all of that, God healed a man. He healed him of depression. He brought him back to a state where he was productive. And that same God can do it for you. Do you believe that? The God of heaven knows how to heal all of our soul's diseases. Now here's how God did this. Keep reading in your chapter. First thing Elijah needed to learn was he needed to get some rest. God knows sometimes when we overdo it. And Elijah had overdone it. And so God let him rest for a little bit, and then he sent him an angel to feed him and to help him to sleep a little bit more. And then God sends him out in the desert in the south for about 40 days, and he spends a little more time out there. We're going to talk about this more tomorrow, but that's meditation time. When you are stuck in a rut, you may need to come face to face with yourself and with your God and spend time there. Even our Lord did that when he withdrew himself into the wilderness for those 40 days, and there he came face to face with the biggest conflict, which was the devil presenting to him. And so as we look at that, sometimes we need to spend our time out here. We also need to spend our time in our Gethsemanes. The Gethsemanes that we are in fervent prayer with God. And what we say is, Lord, not my will, but thine be done. Until we have met our Gethsemane and surrendered ourselves, not my will, but thine be done. Until we meet that, we will stay in the psychological state we're in. And what we need to do is say, Lord, whatever you want me to do, that's what I'm willing to do. No matter what it costs me, that's the price I'm willing to pay. Lord, I'm going to get up and I'm going to do what you want me to do, and I'm going to do it now, and I'm going to trust you to take me by the hand and lead me. Elijah was given time to think about that and to come full face with what was going on with him. In essence, what God did to Elijah, there were no particular sermons and there was no long counseling sessions, but what there was is the nurture and love of God as Elijah came back to core as to who he's really all about and what he's really trying to accomplish in life. He had that time for his R&R. And a lot of us burn the candle at so many ends that we get depressed because we don't have our R&R. I was working with a lady that was about to kill herself. And she didn't want me to tell that story because she worked in the same agency that I worked in. We talked a little bit. And one of the questions I asked her is, obviously she didn't really have so much of a problem as many others do, but yet she was having some feelings. And I asked her, like, when was the last time you went on a vacation? And she said, she used some terms. She said, I haven't been on vacation probably about 8-10 years. It's like, well, what do you do for yourself to bring the energy back in? And she didn't have a good answer. And I said, well, here's what I'm going to ask you to do. What is it you and your husband have a dream of doing? Well, they had a dream of doing their RVing and going to see their kids and all that stuff. I hadn't done that in several years. And so her assignment for me that I got paid for was tell her to go on vacation. You know, when she came back, you know what she said? I should have done that a long time ago. I didn't realize how worn out I was. And I got paid again when she told me that. There were some other things in there. I do work hard sometimes. But anyway, here's what God told Elijah to do. He said, Elijah, I'm going to send you to church. It's the first thing I want to do. And then, Elijah, I want you to tell me what you think the problem is. And we're going to look at that in a minute. And then God said, I'm going to deal with some false thinking you've got. And we're going to get you thinking straight. And when you're thinking straight, your depression is going to lift. And lastly, God gave Elijah a different direction in life. I want to talk about those in a little bit of detail. God sent him to church, is the way we'd say it. God said, I need you to go over to Mount Horeb. That's the Mount of Olives. That's where the law was given to Moses. And there's some things I want you to do. And I want to tell you, one of the first things people need to do when they are depressed, one of the most natural things to do when we're depressed is to isolate. One of the needed things to do when we're depressed is get around God's people. Don't stay home. Don't say, oh, I'm so depressed, I don't want to go to church. Don't want to go to services. And so I just isolate and sit over here and die a slow death. When we're depressed, you need to be around God's people. That's where God took him. And that passage would be borne out also in Galatians 6:2, where it says, bear one another's burdens and so fulfill the law of Christ. How are folks going to help you during things like this if we don't know the situations going on? And often the depressed person will say, well, you know, I don't think anybody cares. Well, nobody knew there was a problem. So what we need to do is to get around God's people, and we need to let somebody in on what's going on with us. And that's one of the first things that we need to do. But our healing of depression doesn't just stop with a house of worship. God sent him to church first, and then God asked Elijah, what do you think the problem is? Now here's how he asked him in verse 13. Elijah, what are you doing here? What are you doing here, Elijah? And God didn't answer the question, or didn't ask the question just once. God asked Elijah the same question two separate times. What are you doing here? Now, didn't God know why Elijah was there? Of course he knew. He had sent Elijah to the mountain. But Elijah needed to verbalize, needed to get that emotional vomit out of his system. He needed to say it, to verbalize it, to be able to see it. He needed to explain what he thought the problem was. And once Elijah verbalized that, he was on his way to healing from his depression. He verbalized what was wrong, and then God said, let me deal with the false beliefs you've got here. You know what Elijah thought was wrong? Elijah thought, I'm the only one who's trying to do anything right. And God is going to clean his plow in just a minute. We'll get there. You know how to clean plow, right? Now God dealt with these. God knew that the truth is going to set him free. And God knew that his false thinking was fueling his depression. And because his beliefs were false, his responses were false, and his chemistry in his body was turned into depression rather than joy. Because his life was not built around the truth, but his life was built around what he thought was going on. Elijah replied to God. His reply to God revealed what was wrong. And here's what was wrong. I have been very zealous for God Almighty, and I'm the only one left. I'm not appreciated for what I've done, and I'm the only one left. And here's what God told him: Elijah, your thinking's wrong, and you need to get out of the bookkeeping business. Because there are several thousand that have not bowed their knee to Baal, and you're not the only one. You need to get off that thing, Elijah. You need to get up, and you need to quit taking care of my business. I'm God, you're not. My job's not posted. By the way, have any of us ever applied for the God position? Sometimes we act like that's a posted position, and it's not. So God now corrects his thinking. He says, I have 7,000 in Israel that are just like you. And here's what I want us to see. When we're feeling isolated and alone, we need to know we're not in this by ourselves. We need to link with those others who are in this with us, and we need to stand with them. Elijah seems to be saying, I haven't done anything wrong. What are you doing, God? And God says, well, let me just tell you what I'm doing. I want you to get up now and get out of here. Get up and go do something. Here's what you're going to do. You're going to go down to Damascus by way of the desert. You're going to anoint Hazael, the king over Aram. You're going to anoint Jehu, the king over Israel. And you're going to anoint Elisha to succeed you as a prophet. And Jehu will put to death any that escape the sword of Hazael. And Elisha will put to death any who escape the sword of Jehu. Verse 15 through 17. In other words, what God told Elijah is, don't you worry about it. I've got it under control. And I am doing something. How dare you imply that I'm not here? And that's the message for us when we're depressed. Who are we to think God's not on duty? But he was. When a person's depressed, sometimes the last thing that we look at, perhaps, is that God is present and he's there in time of trouble. And then God said, here's something else I want you to do. You've been at what you've been doing too long. And you're burnt out. And you need to take a new course in life and not be afraid to step up and accept the challenge. Here's what you're going to do for the rest of your life, my friend. You're going to get up and you're going to develop a school for the prophets. And Elijah is going to be one of your students. Or Elisha is going to be one of your students. And when he comes out of this whole thing, he's going to know what he knows, and he's going to know what you know, so he's going to know more than you know. And he is going to be greater and mightier even than you. And I need you to go out and to anoint these kings, because I'm not done with you yet. There's something else left to do. Sometimes things depress us in life. About 13 years ago now, I was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. I didn't know whether I'd live or die. But I lived. And God had a mission. Part of that is what I'm doing now. Oh yeah. The valley of despair. And Lord, you spared me. Why? Am I done? Is it all over? No. And God has a mission for you. Step up. Accept the challenge. And like that Nike swoosh, just do it. Just do it. Well, during the first part of the 20th century, there was a man who had amassed a little bit of an empire. He was known very well in the department store industry. In fact, his empire was 1,700 stores, and they were all thriving. But he'd overextended himself, and then in 1929, everything came to a screeching halt with the Great Depression. And he lost everything he had. He went into such despondency that he thought it was all over. He didn't want to live. His family, fearing for that he would be suicidal, put him into a mental institution. And there, he kept getting worse and worse. And no one knew what was going to happen to this man. He refused to listen to anything anybody would tell him. He's been on the help of the doctors. And one day, someone had talked him into taking a little walk. And he took a walk past the chapel in this facility. And he heard him singing a song. Be not dismayed, whatever betide. God will take care of you. Beneath His wings of love abide. God will take care of you. Oh yes, God will take care of you through every day or all the way. He will take care of you. God will take care of you. Do you believe that? Why would we despair? Why would we live in hopelessness? Why would we be helpless when our help and our deliverer and our Savior is watching and is there every step of the way? There's not a night so dark but that He is there. There's not an experience you have but that God knows. There's not a secret thought you have but that God is there. He knows you better than you know yourself. And so rather than looking down, may God grant that we look up. Heaven's our home. This world has its triumphs and its valleys, but the greatest lessons are learned in the valleys.